It's the Fri-Yay Cocktail with Anna Gleminski.
So bloody minded, that's also a bit of a phrase. You know, we've just been talking about metaphors here and where they come from. But it's also the title of Alex Dowsett's book. And it's got a double meaning as well, which I love. I think it's referring to his determination, really, to make it as a cyclist in a cutthroat athletic world, but also with his history and diagnosis of haemophilia. So there's more meanings to it than you just see in the title. But I'm delighted to be joined by Alex right now. And like I said earlier on, this is a book about cycling. But Alex, you know, hi, and thank you for joining me. This book isn't necessarily just for cycling fans, would you say?
No. Yes, I would say that it's not just for cycling fans. Sorry.
A double negative.
Yeah. No, because there's, I think, being brutally honest, if you put my Palmares as a standalone without the haemophilia sort of side quest, it'd be questionable whether they kind of warrant a book. Whereas I think with what I've had to overcome, which is funny saying that about yourself, because I don't really feel like I've overcome anything. It's all just felt like my life, part of my story. I having haemophilia and everything that goes with it is kind of feels like I wake up and have breakfast each morning. It's normal. It's a very surreal thing to now be in a book. But yeah, so to answer your question, no, I think anyone would take something from it. A lot of it is around my parents, what they had to endure with my diagnosis and my childhood. And then there's a healthy dose of sport. Cycling is such a sport that's steeped in so much history and stories that there's a lot of those anecdotes involved. And just a bit of a stubborn nature approach to doing something I, on paper, shouldn't have been able to do.
And why shouldn't you have been able to do it? Because some people maybe don't even know what haemophilia is.
I think haemophilia, there's a long way of describing it and a short way. I'll go with the short way. Haemophilia is my blood without medication doesn't clot. The medication's reasonably new in that it kicked off just before I was born. So I was very lucky in when I was born. So it's very much a new age for haemophiliacs that are now, I think it references in the book a few times, I'm the only elite athlete with haemophilia in sport currently, but I always like to refer to myself as the first, because in the medication changes means there'll be a lot more coming. I was just lucky there, really. But lucky and with that attitude of when you spend a childhood of being told no. So wasn't allowed to play football at school, wasn't allowed to play rugby because they're contact sports, risk of internal bleeding. If you're a kid being told no quite a lot, you develop a bit of an attitude to go out there and either rebel or be determined to show the world what you can really do, which I think was more my story, and very fortunate, and I had parents that recognised that. Willing to throw a little bit of caution to the wind with regard to my haemophilia. I guess the rest, as I say, is history, but it really did work out far better than what the prognosis was when I was a kid. But sort of to summarise, when I told my haemophilia specialist doctor that I'd taken up competitive road cycling, their exact words were, "We'd rather you play chess or a musical instrument, but if that's what you want to do, we will support you." And I'm just very fortunate there as well with the NHS.
And would you say that it really is the medication that allowed you to pursue that career? Because the idea is, if you ever crashed on your bike, and actually I'm going to ask you as well, have you ever crashed on your bike, you could potentially bleed and bleed out, not be able to stop.
Yeah, certainly the medication is the medication change is a pivotal moment in haemophilia's history. You would have seen haemophilia in the news recently with the sort of blood contamination scandal. I avoided that by sort of five years, basically, even less maybe, which is very lucky. For me, I horrendously unlucky for those involved. If I was born in the 60s, my life expectancy wouldn't be past kind of 20 to 25 years old.
My goodness.
That's how much it's, yeah. And then that's how much it's changed. Just internal bleeding into joints, into muscles, is massively debilitating. You, older haemophiliacs will often have what they'll call arthritis, but it's accelerated joint damage through bleeding into joints. And a lot of them will have fused elbows, fused ankles, crutches, wheelchairs, all of that, just through the blood not being able to coagulate. So it's the internal stuff that's actually far more damaging than the external stuff. It's often people like, oh, so if you get a paper cut or you bleed to death without any medication, no. But yeah, internal bleeding is a bit of a nightmare.
I'm really glad you picked that up, actually, because that is, a lot of that is news to me. I was of that mindset of, you know, paper cut, bleed to death, so, and the risk of crashing. I wasn't so aware of the internal risks and what that posed. And I mean, obviously you put yourself out there having this career as an athlete at an international level. Have you had people get in touch with haemophilia, or especially like children or younger people that have looked up to you as an inspiration? You know, you said that you were the first. You like to believe that other people can follow in your footsteps, whether that's in your sport or in other sports. Have you seen any realities of that coming through?
Yes, certainly. Yeah, for sure. I speak to young haemophiliacs, and often their parents, there's still stories of sort of big hardships. But there's more stories now appearing of actually young haemophiliacs saying they don't know what an internal bleeding episode feels like because the medication's so good now. Whereas I know I had them when I was a kid. I know what it feels like. I mean, with that, you've then got a whole host of different issues where you are telling a young, and it's boys, it's 99%. Generally, females carry the disease, whereas boys have it. So I've got two daughters. They are both carriers of haemophilia, but they won't be affected by the condition themselves. They'll just possibly pass it on. So you're asking... So now with these young boys who have an injection every, because that's how the medication's given, have an injection every week or every second day, have never actually felt the consequences of their condition, and you're still asking them to sit out like rugby. More boys are playing football now, which is great. You're still asking them to sit out rugby, like a boxing ring just is not, it's not on the cards for any young haemophiliac. I do understand the irony of being a professional cyclist and the risks involved and the crashes, but I think the main message, and I know I've been an inspiration, possibly even a nuisance, where there's been parents at the Royal London Hospital, which is my one, go, yes, yes, we know about the cyclist. which is, you know, it's nice. I think actually one of the most important messages I've sent, though, without meaning to, I was at a global conference for haemophilia in Barcelona in like 2015, I think, and a Portuguese nurse got up and said, I think what you're doing is irresponsible.
Right.
Because I don't think it's not, we shouldn't be promoting this within haemophilia. And I was pretty floored, but I was fortunate because I had my consultant with me. We were both speakers. And my consultant said, well, let's take the flip side to what Alex is doing. If Alex was not an athlete, he wouldn't be as fit and healthy as he is. And we're pretty confident that that helps contribute to his ability to have a really positive experience with the condition. He'd be a lot heavier. which would be, or a bit heavier, I don't know, 20 kilos, which would be more medication. And if we talk about the cost, more of a cost to the NHS. So I think it's actually the reverse. And then at the same conference, a mother said, what does your team do when you crash? I said, every team asks me. I said, well, if I crash bad enough that I can't carry on the race, then I probably need to go to hospital. And if I crash and I can carry on the race, then I will. I just might have a little bit more medication when I get back to the hotel or home. And they said, okay, so actually from our point of view, not really any different to anyone else on the team. I said, I guess not. I said, I can tell you hospital's going to panic when I arrive, but ultimately, no, from your standpoint, that's no different. And what that gave to that mother is like, well, you are in a fundamentally high-risk environment. Crashes do happen. In every single race, there is a crash. For about half of my career, I would break a bone every 2 years in a crash. It was part and parcel. And she kind of thought, well, if you're in that environment and your team's not treating you any differently to anyone else, then why should my son be treated any differently in school? And I think he shouldn't really. As long as everyone around him, the adults, the carers are aware, then there is no good reason. And so I think that was I really realized the importance of my story at that moment within the haemophilia community.
Oh, it's life-changing, potentially, for kids with haemophilia. So I definitely get why you want to tell the story from that point of view. But also, just for your life as a cyclist, you know, it's not the biggest sport in the UK. It's bigger in many other countries. And you've been lucky enough to race and compete and be part of the international racing circuit. Can you just give an overview, I suppose, of what that life is like? What types of races would you do? What is life like as an international professional cyclist?
Oh, it's nuts. Now that I've been retired for 2 years now, and it's more nuts now that I lead a more normal life than, looking back on what I did. It's having a suitcase half packed 365 days of the year. It's getting teams looking far more polished from the outside than they are on the inside. So it's getting a boarding pass through on your emails for a race that you had no idea you were doing. And a boarding pass for the next day. You're like, oh, I guess I have to go. It's being, I think the tiredness, the levels of fatigue are staggering. As listen to a podcast, you listen to these sort of very inspirational people who say, I get up and I exercise and that gives me energy for the day. I was like, I don't understand, because I get up, I exercise, and I'm pretty much bound to my sofa for the rest of the day. And then I move from my sofa to bed, and that's all I'm capable of. So it's exercising to exhaustion most days, but that being the norm. Like I'm a casual cyclist now, and I look back at what I used to do. A 4 hour ride was considered a regular day. 80 miles, 4 hours, that was a normal training day. It wasn't a lot, it wasn't a little. That was like a standard day in the saddle. An hour and a quarter is about, not my limit now, but that's when the novelty wears off. That's when I'm sort of wondering what else I can do. I have a lot more respect for what I used to do now than I did when I was in it. And the races are, you go everywhere. Like I've traveled all over the world, but not seen much.
Right.
I'd say, because I've not been looking a lot of the time. You do sort of the Giro d'Italia, say, which is the equivalent of the Tour de France, but in Italy, And I remember my dad would go, "Where are you?" I don't know. He'd go, "What do you mean you don't know?" I was like, "Well, it's stage 10, so we're halfway through the race. It started at the bottom of Italy. It finishes at the top. My guess is we're somewhere in the middle." It's just because you're just tired.
Yeah, all the time. You've got a job to do.
Exactly. I think I raced 2 years running 500 meters from the Colosseum in Rome, and I did not see it.
Wow. you mentioned there the Tour de France. You know, that is probably the most famous race in the world for people who don't follow cycling. Can you just tell us a little bit about the distances, the amount of climbing involved, and some of the different things that you're racing for as well? You've obviously got a race leader, but you also have different prizes within that race itself.
Yeah, so it's the Tour de France, and there's, I think, like I said before, there's one in Italy and there's one in Spain as well, the Giro d'Italia, the Vuelta a España. They are all similar distances, similar amount of climbing. But the Tour de France is just a bit different in that every single team takes their A team. They don't take anyone new, any youngsters for experience. Everyone is there because they are the best in each of the teams. And that's, it's like in football, it's like every team is taking their championship final A squad kind of thing. It's the only race where you sit down before the race as an entire peloton in a kind of amphitheater. I likened it to, if you go go-karting, you sit in a room and you learn all the safety procedures. You kind of do that for the Tour de France. And I just remember it being one of the most intimidating things, looking around the room and seeing, I was like, oh, everyone here is very, very good. Very good. So on average, I think it equates to about 100 miles a day. I'd say usually a little bit longer, because you've got a few time trial days. Two or three stages will be time trials, which was my specialist. That's where everyone starts in 1 minute intervals, fastest time wins. The rest of the stages, everyone starts together, first across the finish line wins the stage. You can win the entire race without winning any of the 21 stages in the race. That hasn't, usually the person that wins the yellow jersey has won a number of stages along the way. The overall is generally won by being quickest in the mountains, quickest in the time trials, and not crashing and not getting ill. I'd say there's no sporting event like it on the planet where you can, if you win a stage of the Tour de France, it's career defining. And in any other sport, if you were to win something that's career defining, you'd have a good few weeks to celebrate. But you might, if it's anything other than stage 21, you might have half a glass of champagne in the evening, go to bed, and then you're back on a start line the next day to do the exact same thing all over again. It's, there's 20-mile mountains, there's altitude, all weathers. It's brutal.
It is brutal. And it also has an atmosphere as well. You know, it's the competition in cycling that draws the crowds, it draws the public. You've got people screaming at you on the sidelines. What's that like as well?
It's amazing. It really is amazing, actually, to be riding, 100 miles and just have 1, 2, 3 deep people like the entire way.
Wow.
Like, all the way. We do stop for a wee every so often during stages because it's not full gas from start to finish. Usually it starts fast, there's a low in the middle, and then it finishes fast. In the low in the middle, we'll try and find somewhere to wee. Very difficult with the amount of spectators there are along the course in the Tour de France. it's wonderful. Compared to the other races, it adds a whole new dimension of euphoria, but also like stress, because there is no time to relax. You always feel like you're yeah, when there's a crowd, it really does bring something, and yeah, you get energy from that. But then when you finish a stage, you're just like, that all just dissipates, and you feel very flat when you get to your Holiday Inn hotel room.
Yeah, but still, like you say, looking back on it, you can see really how amazing it was, and it's, you've experienced something that so many people will never even get close to experiencing in their whole lives. It is amazing. You also mentioned as well that your forte is time trialing, so it's you against the clock. Now, there's this thing called the hour record, which you have different relationships with that record. First of all, can you tell us what it is?
The hour record's, it's possibly the simplest bicycle race on the planet. It is as far as you can travel in an hour from a standing start. And it's always done officially inside a velodrome. So 250-meter banked indoor cycling track. Yeah, that's pretty much it, Anna. That's
riding
the race.
Around in a circle for 1 hour as fast as you can. You've had some success with that. Let's talk about the success story.
Well, it's interesting. I attempted it twice, and I view both of them as a success in their own way. The first time I did it, I covered 52.937 kilometers, which was enough to break the world record at the time. In miles, I think that's about 32 miles.
So if we just sum that up, that is going steadily at nearly 60 kilometers an hour for a whole hour.
I like that you said nearly 60, yes.
It's just because you went into like decimal numbers there, and nobody needs that.
Yeah, no. Okay, like, 53 kilometers in an hour, and that was enough to break the record. I was happy. And then Wiggins came along and broke that record.
So another very famous British cyclist, Sir Bradley Wiggins.
Yes. Yeah. He did 54 and a half kilometers. That was then broken to 55.2. Then I then went back for a second try, because even though I'd broken the record in 2015, I felt like I could have gone further, faster and further. It was the epitome, that attempt was the epitome of like train hard, fight easy. Even though it was a very simple event, it becomes a very complicated thing to do, because you're trying to run the risk of not going over your limit. Because once you go over your limit, it's very difficult to come back from that. And so we were very cautious. We hadn't made some mathematical mistakes, but I think we'd just underestimated how fast race day would be. You put the temperature up in the velodrome, warmer air makes the conditions faster. We went from the London velodrome to the Manchester one, which was a little bit faster. Race day tires, things like that, just make it faster. So in 2015, as much as I broke the record, I kind of thought there was more in the tank there. It gave me a bit of a desire to go back, try and get the record back, but also show myself what I could really do. So we went back in 2021. We were due to go back in 2020, but COVID. Went back in 21 and I did 54.555 kilometers. Sorry for the decimal points, but I was 8 meters further than 8 meters further than Bradley Wiggins went. But unfortunately for me, the record had been moved on to 55.2. at the time, so it wasn't enough to break the record. But yeah, I came away from that and I was like, it's a very respectable distance. It's still kind of the fifth or the sixth furthest attempt in history. And because it was I did it privately, kind of off my own back with personal sponsors, we raised £55,000 for, ironically, like 54 and a half kilometers, but we raised £55,000 for my charity, Little Bleeders, and the Haemophilia Society. So, you know, whilst the second one didn't break a world record, I'm almost prouder of that than I was the record breaking.
Oh, it's definitely right. Worth taking your hat off to. It is incredible, and it sounds like you've processed it in such a positive way. But your book, and you know, I really want to sort of promote, I suppose, the book to the listeners, opens with the story of not getting the record. And it was very, I suppose it's just really human to anyone who's ever most people wouldn't have tried to risk, have never tried to risk something, go for something in such a public way and not get it. And I found that section of the book so raw. And because, like I say, it's relatable, most people won't necessarily go for the hour record, but people will face moments in their lives where they have the opportunity to risk something and not achieve it in front of people, and people won't take that risk because of that fear of failure. And that's what I think I find so relatable about that part of the story. And obviously you've processed it really well. What did it feel like at the time when you were actually doing it? And was there a moment where you thought, actually, I don't think I'm going to get this? And did you feel it?
I knew after 35 minutes, so still had 25 minutes left. I knew I wasn't going to get it. And no amount of, I don't want that to sound defeatist over the, like, to anyone listening, because it's kind of a numbers game. If I lose, I'm struggling to hold the lap time I need to hold every lap, every 16.3 seconds. It suddenly it slipped to 16.4 seconds, 16.5. That builds up. And so that I know at some point in the last 25 minutes, and I'm struggling here, I know I don't need to get back to 16.3s. I need to get now back to 16.2s, 1s, 0s. And I can't, no matter how hard I try, I can't get back to 16.3s. So I kind of then just know that I kind of, at that point, I know it's gone, but I also know that I'm still going much faster than my previous record. And I know, to sort of allude to what you were saying to start with, I'm a big one, especially as I got older in my career, a big one for trying to think ahead, whether that be a year, like a month, an hour record, or sort of simply to the end of a 4 or 5 hour training ride on a cold, wet, windy day. I try and think about how will I feel. Sure, I maybe don't want to do this. And I promise you, no bike rider looks out the window at a cold and wet day, cold, rainy day, and goes, I want to do 5 hours, 100 miles in the rain today. No one. I used to think about how am I going to feel about myself at 5 p.m. tonight if I don't do this? And I'm going to feel pretty rotten about it. And I know if I do this, then I'm not going to enjoy it whilst I do it. I'm going to be very proud of myself when I'm finished. And that to me was the important thing. And I knew if I finished my cycling career without having another go at the hour record, whether it was to break a record or not, just to really, you know, not train hard, fight easy, but train hard and fight hard as well. That was the most important thing to me. So it wasn't, a lot of people afterwards said like, oh, we were surprised you finished the hour when you knew it was slipping away. I was like, well, there was no question. Yeah. Absolutely no question of finishing it or not. Yeah, that was my mentality.
Well, it's completely inspirational to whatever anyone's going through in life, you know, cycling related or not. And in that shell, or in that note, if you can just wrap up really, really quickly, because it's jam-packed full of stories, just what we've gone through today. What do you hope that people get out of your book?
An honest insight into life as an athlete with a twist. Of being a haemophilia, but also a pretty raw, account. There was no, I held nothing back to a point where there's a few eyebrows raised because like my whole relationship with my wife is put in there as well. And that was, a lot of people like, we were surprised you left that in. I was like, yep. And in hindsight, so am I.
Well, it sounds really juicy, absolutely fascinating. We've got to jump to a break into the news, so we'll leave it there. But Alex, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, his book is called Bloody Minded, My Life in Cycling. You can check it out on the Talk Radio Europe bookshop, or of course, pop it into Google and find it pretty much anywhere.